10% of the calves in these data sets had not received any viral vaccine. And now in 2006 and 2007, that's less than 3%. So obviously the market has responded. Sellers or buyers are seeing a benefit from these calves, are willing to pay more money for them, and we're seeing sellers are vaccinating their calves. Now, I would explain, this is not all the cattle that are sold in Superior. These are the large sales in the summer, primarily the Ford contract fall delivery large sales. Usually there are 6 to 8 of these per year. And the reason that that's the only data analyzed is those are the only sales where we have enough numbers where we can statistically analyze the different VAC programs. And these years typically these years represent about 400,000 to 500,000 calves per year. So there's several million calves now in this data set. Now, unfortunately, that's all great that we know we can get better production performance from calves than in a VAC 45 program. But as Dr. Jim McGran states, preconditioning is a marginal business, and added revenue has to be greater than the added cost. And that's been questionable. There's been a lot of argument about that for years, for decades. We've been arguing, does preconditioning pay? Okay. We look at the input costs that we have today, feed costs, fuel costs, labor costs, and I haven't really rerun those budgets or seen budgets in the last few months, but it's going to be even harder to make preconditioning pay, even though we know we get those price premiums are there, but it may not be enough if we don't have a very cost-effective weaning management program. So I wanted to conclude today with just talking about a couple of alternative weaning options that you may want to think about. These are certainly not new, but I wanted to talk about some new data, particularly with dry lot backgrounding versus pasture. But fence line weaning is something that if you haven't tried, I'd highly recommend you try that. This picture is some early wean calves that I had a couple of years ago. It's the first time I tried fence line weaning, and I was very pleased with the results. There's some good data to support that. It reduces stress and can reduce respiratory mortality and morbidity. And as Dr. Ron Gill says, every ranch deserves one good fence, and you can see a picture here of my one good fence. And it was just a six-strand tight barbed wire fence and had no problems with the calves and cows getting together. As far as fence line weaning data, this is a study that's published in Journal of Animal Science by Price, and they showed that with fence line weaning, there were decreased vocalizations, increased eating behavior, and less walking activity, calves that were fence line weaned versus not fence line weaned. And the bottom line is there was better weight gain when you compare fence line contact with no contact. So in this case, 110 pounds versus at 10 weeks versus 91 pounds with those that had no contact. Now, another alternative to think about with weaning programs is looking at pasture weaning versus dry lot weaning. And Dr. Clay Mathis at New Mexico State University and his colleagues recently did some work. It was a 3-year study looking at the differences between pasture preconditioning and dry lot preconditioning. And here I have the advantages and disadvantages of each program, which they're obvious. One of the concerns about pasture preconditioning is less gain, and you can certainly get better gain with dry lot preconditioning. But with pasture preconditioning, we have less dust, which could contribute to respiratory disease. We have less dietary change. We have less environmental change. Just overall, less stressful way to wean calves. Just to tell you the treatment protocol, this was a 46 to 54 day study. The dry lot preconditioned calves received a preconditioning pellet that was primarily a wheat mid corn based pellet and alfalfa hay. They were fed once a day, and the pasture weaned calves were put on pasture that had been deferred over the summer, and then they were put on it in the fall with a 32% range cube at 1.25 pounds per day delivered 3 times per week. So it wasn't fed every day. It was just fed 3 times per week like we normally would feed range cubes. So here's the results of that study. And this is a a fairly small study, but I think it speaks to some of the alternatives and opportunities that we may have with this type weaning program. The first 20 days, the pasture calves gain statistically better, and then when you look at the overall 45-day period, as would be expected, the dry lot preconditioned calves gain 1.41 pounds versus 1.10 with the pasture calves. So there was a distinct improvement in gain for the dry lot calves. But when we look at it from a financial standpoint, the net income difference between those pasture weaned calves and the dry lot weaned calves was $44. So it, even though they didn't perform as well, it was an economic advantage for the pasture calves. And then when they were carried on to the feedlot, overall there was really no difference in gain. But when we look at percent treated and percent that died in the feedlot, there were some significant differences, particularly in death loss. Death loss on those calves that were dry lot backgrounded was 7.6% versus zero in the pasture. Now, this was a small study, and I'm not suggesting that this would be duplicated and have that kind of a difference in death loss, but there was a difference, and that's what the study showed. The net income difference was $103 per head, and about $70 of that difference was in death loss. But something about the way those calves were weaned and preconditioned on pasture had an impact even into the feedlot. Was it the dust? Was it dust in those conditions setting up potential for respiratory disease that was in those cattle and was just still present when they went to the feedlot? I don't know the answer to that, but for whatever reason, pasture preconditioning was a much more economically beneficial alternative. So that's all. All I wanted to discuss today. I just touched on a few things to think about in ranch BRD control, not just the direct inputs that we give to the calf, but how we manage that cow herd may have the most dramatic impact on how our calves perform after they leave the ranch. And certainly we need to look at some alternatives in these times of rising prices with our weaning management programs. So with that, I'll close, and I'll be glad to, how are we doing on time? We have time for a few questions, Bridget? Okay. Yes, sir. Bob. Well, somebody in the room may be able to answer this better than I, but from what there's been a lot of studies comparing banding and surgical castration It seems, my interpretation is it's almost a wash. Some show benefit one way and some show benefit the other. I think a lot of it, there's a lot of differences in technician. There's technician differences in how they're surgically castrated. So those are hard to evaluate. I don't know, does somebody in the room may have actually done some of those studies, but I know there's been a number of them done. Some show a benefit to band and some show a benefit to surgical castration. My personal preference is surgical castration whenever possible. Because you add the expense of the tetanus vaccine that's essential and the expense of the band. But I know there's certainly times with large cutting bulls when banding is good for certain operations. Any other questions? Yes.
Have you seen any difference in the weight gain of calves that have been castrated pre-7 days of age as opposed to calves that are castrated, say, 5 to 6 weeks of age at, say, a branding setting or something like that?
I'm not aware of any differences in you're referring to, say, the day they're born versus, yeah. I'm not aware of differences. I think even if you did see some differences when you look at the the welfare benefits of vaccinating these calves earlier and the reduced respiratory morbidity, I think it would offset any potential you might have for some weight gain, but that's just my personal bias. My personal bias is to castrate calves as early as is possible. And I know doing them, if you're tagging calves on day one, catching calves and tagging them, to me that's a good time to castrate. And I know there's people that would certainly differ with me on that. Any other questions? Okay, we'll turn it over to the next speaker.
Our next speaker this morning is Dr. Mitch Blanding. He's currently a veterinarian with beef veterinary operations at Pfizer Animal Health. He's a graduate of Kansas State University, and he spent 9 years in private practice. He's been involved in the industry for the past 5 years and is currently living in the Kansas City area. Welcome, Dr. Blanding.
Can you hear me? Okay, ladder back there. Up, turn it up. I'll just hold it. How's that? I'm going to use the little mic. I get kind of claustrophobic when I'm standing behind a podium, so bear with me down here. If I trip over the cord, please don't laugh because I'm kind of sensitive about that. So, and usually when I step up on the podium or step up on the stage, I usually trip up the stairs, so that's not a good thing either. How's everybody this morning? Good? For those of you that aren't from an area where they have gambling, did anybody participate last night? Try their luck? Any winners? Any losers? They didn't build these places on winners, you know that? So, luckily I stayed away. I don't have very good luck at that. So we'll go ahead and get started. I've been asked to talk about prevention and control of respiratory disease, and Dr. Rogers did an excellent job of kind of setting the stage and talking about disease management, particularly respiratory disease management at the ranch. And what I've been asked to talk about is as these cattle move from the ranch and move to the next kind of the next phase that we have in this industry and in the feeder calf portion of the industry, what can we do to impact respiratory disease at that level? And specifically what I'm going to talk about is prevention and control. And what I'm going to talk about within these next 20 minutes or so, 30 minutes, is are there some goals of an arrival program that we can look at? And I'm going to kind of take a 30,000-foot view of this thing. It's going to be kind of a philosophical-type discussion and talk about strategies more than pure specifics. We're not going to have a lot of product discussion here, and I think we can certainly do that another time. And we welcome you all to stop by, you know, our booth later on. But I'm also going to talk about what we call the BRD triad, and that's specifically prevention, control, and therapy. We'll talk a little bit about that and differentiate between them. And then we'll talk about the benefits of controlling disease, and particularly respiratory disease, the benefits of the operation kind of beyond the cattle itself. So that's kind of the set the stage of what we're going to talk about. So as we look at this, and this is some work that was put together, or actually compiled, some data that was compiled by Dr. Calvin Booker and the group that he works with, and they're a veterinary consulting firm out of Canada, consult with a large number of feed yards, both in Canada and the U.S., but this is some of the information put together by the yards that they do some work for. And this is 2004 data, and so I apologize for that. I don't have any of the updated data. And I also apologize for those of you clearing the back. You may have difficulty reading this. But basically what this shows is what are the total production costs in taking a 450-pound calf from start or receiving, once we enter in the feeding phase, to slaughter. And I think when you look at it in this way, some of you may be surprised, but obviously the largest production cost associated with that is feed, okay? And you think there's some sensitivity right now to input costs in this industry? Okay, feed where it's at, record levels, record high levels. What about fuel? Okay, so there's quite a bit of sensitivity in the industry right now to input costs. And a lot of that gets expressed in some of these other input costs like animal health. You can't see that pointer. But if we look at animal health specifically, it's in their data, it's sitting at around 6.3% of total input costs, okay? So a relatively small chunk of the pie, if you will. They had it about $35 per head, and that includes, you know, processing costs and any medicine costs that goes in associated with treatment of disease, mostly respiratory disease. You can see some of the other costs they accounted for, yardage, interest. They wrapped death loss in there as a separate kind of a category, but it could probably be lumped into animal health as well. Bedding, that's Canadian. They like to utilize the term bedding, and that we kind of lump it into yardage probably more often in the U.S. But as you can see, some of the other input costs make up a relatively small piece of the pie. You could argue right now that with today's record feed costs that blue portion of the pie has probably gotten a little bit larger. Surely on a dollar amount, maybe not so much as a percentage basis, but there's some more dollars involved, particularly in feed costs. So my argument has always been, and I think those of us in the animal health industry has always been, is there something that we can do with that relatively small piece of the pie that we have? Can we make some decisions that's going to impact other parts of our operations, specifically the feed costs? Can we improve efficiency by reducing disease? Can we improve efficiency of the group, make these animals more efficient, and have a greater impact on our feed? Yeah, I think the answer is yes. There's quite a bit of data that would support that. This is kind of the same information, but what they've done here is thrown in the purchase price of the animal. Okay, and you can see if you look at it in that way, you know, our animal health costs are even a smaller piece of the pie. And it's a kind of, you know, I know we're always, as I say, we're sensitive to input costs, especially at this particular point in the industry, and we're always looking to, you know, to save a buck here and a buck there, or a penny here and a penny there, depending upon your situation. But I think there's probably certain places we can trim costs, and there's probably certain places where if we evaluate some of these input costs as more of an investment as opposed to just an expense, I think we may be able to do ourselves some favors. The receiving program. The receiving program is kind of like the quarterback of a football team. Probably gets more credit than it deserves when things are going well, and probably gets more blame than it deserves when things aren't going so well. What are the goals of a receiving program? Well, the first thing we'd like to do is be able to reduce sickness, reduce morbidity, minimize the number of animals that actually get sick. And somewhere in there, if we're able to do that, we can probably reduce the ones that die. If we can have fewer animals that get sick, we're probably going to have fewer animals that die, fewer chronics along with it, because those are the ones that obviously don't respond to therapy very well and they wind up being chronics. Somewhere in there, if we're making the right choices with our animal health program or receiving program, and we're making some sound philosophical decisions and strategies, we're probably going to improve our response to treatment. Doing a better job on the receiving end, certainly on the front end of it, I think sets us up, and the data would suggest, sets us up for a better response to treatment down the road when we do actually have to pull and treat some of these animals. And through all that, if we're kind of accomplishing all those things, we're probably going to have improved performance in the group as a whole. Okay, anybody disagree with any of that? It requires a combination of management, nutrition, and animal health products, or animal health specifically. Okay, which is kind of like the three-legged stool. You take one of those away, and it's going to impact the whole operation. All right, they're pretty closely intertwined, if you will. We'd like to talk about there's basically three places to intervene, and I'm talking specifically now about bovine respiratory disease. You basically got three places to intervene. We can intervene with prevention. In other words, so what can we do to prevent an animal from getting sick? Right, there's things that Dr. Rogers just talked about, things that can occur at the ranch of origin that we can employ or utilize, tools that we have available to us that we can utilize to actually reduce disease once these animals get to the next step, the feeding phase. Okay? Are there some things that we can do once we receive the animals into the feeding phase? Are there some things we can do? Yeah, absolutely. Okay, but we're trying to prevent disease from occurring. Control is kind of the next step, and it kind of occurs simultaneously. Prevention is applying deworming and vaccination strategies. Control is applying an antibiotic to the group, okay, oftentimes referred to as metaphylaxis or mass treatment. What we're trying to accomplish there, we've recognized that depending upon the animals that we're dealing with and what occurred at the ranch of origin, and lots of times we don't know that. You know, we receive some animals in the feeding segment of this industry, we oftentimes receive animals that we really don't know any history on. You know, we don't know where they come from, what sort of management strategies they've had applied at the ranch of origin. And so it's kind of a crapshoot, if you will. We get a set of calves, it's kind of like being dealt a set of cards. We really don't know what we've got until we kind of take a look at them, get into them, and see what we've got. Then once we move on from prevention and control, then we apply therapy. That's the third place to intervene with respiratory disease. These are animals that actually get sick sometime during the early receiving period or any time during the feeding period, for that matter. We actually have to pull and treat. Okay? The most efficient place to intervene is with prevention and control. That's where we get the most return on our investment because we're managing cattle at that point as a group. It's much more efficient, much more effective than managing cattle as individuals. Okay, once we start pulling and treating individuals, that's when we can start running into problems. It's an inexact science, and we run into some problems by doing that. And generally, when we get to that point, we're behind the eight ball. This is just a graphical depiction of kind of what we're up against when we receive a set of cattle. All right? Animals are at various levels of risk or various classifications of risk. You know, we often refer to animals as high risk, and that's because they've had several stress factors applied to them sometime during the weaning and marketing process, okay? There's been some insult on their immune system. Maybe they're coming from an area that's maybe been under the influence of droughts. So maybe we've got drought stress animals coming in that maybe are immunocompromised because of the level of nutrition. Maybe they have trace mineral deficiencies. Who knows? Again, it's kind of like a set of cards. Maybe they went through the marketing channel and have been exposed to significant co-mingling.